From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Clint Odom, Senior Vice President of Policy and Executive Director of the Washington Bureau.
And I'm Tony Wiley, Director of Advocacy for the National Urban League.
Tony, I'm really excited about the fact that the fall has really arrived in full bloom. We've got snowstorms, we've got football playoffs coming up, we've got the holiday season, Kwanzaa, Christmas, Hanukkah, it's all coming. Festivus for the rest of us is all coming to an end, and we're about to turn the page on 2019. Can you believe it?
Yeah, it's been a very interesting year. I will say that it's great to have at least one major winter holiday under our belts, and I am speaking of belts and kind of stuff. But I think another good thing about this particular holiday is that a lot of people who work for our federal government, they are able to receive their paychecks.
Sure.
We did get an extension on the funding of our government through December 20th.
Yep. We weren't so sure that was going to happen. So, you know, we kind of flagged this as a possibility in some of our publications and maybe even one of our podcast shows. But the Congress passed and the president signed into law.
That's something to definitely be thankful for because, as we know, people who work for the government, they do a tremendous job every day, and also the programs that are funded through our government that help all of our people throughout the country in those communities are very important. So hopefully everyone had a very good and thankful holiday because of that.
Absolutely. Well, another reason to be excited, not just the season, but this is the first of its kind show for our podcast For the Movement. We've never done before today a national security foreign affairs show. So I couldn't think of a better person to bring in to help usher in our first episode on foreign affairs, a friend and colleague by the name of Haley Soifer, who is the executive director of the Jewish Democratic Council of America. And she's a foreign affairs expert, served in the State Department in the Obama administration, and was a senior staffer for Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power. So we thought, since national security is really at its essence about physical security, something that is missing often in our communities, this feeling of security in our homes, security in our bodies, security in our just walking around, that we would talk about this really important issue. And we thought perhaps the situation in northern Syria would be as good an example as any to bring a spotlight to, so that people could understand why is it that things that are happening 3,000 miles are halfway across the globe, why does that matter to us? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question is it matters a lot, because what goes on outside of this country is often a reflection of what's happening inside. And so I thought this would be a really good show to bring to folks in the movement to educate them about certain things, so that when they're listening to the nightly news and they hear the words Northern Syria, ISIS, the Kurds, they don't have to sort of turn off their hearing or wonder what it is that they're even talking about. Maybe we could give folks a little context and show them why what's going on there matters to us right here.
Yeah, and this season of really thinking about our family and our friends, as we learned through the podcast that the Kurds were our friends on the ground there in Syria, and we kind of stepped away from a friend. And that is something that I think is unique to our foreign policy in the past, because the U.S. has been known to be a good ally.
Right. We've actually gone to war when our friends have been attacked. And we've been a reliable ally to so many people, as other people have been to us.
Right. And so it kind of brings back to my remembrance our friends in the Bahamas, who, because of a natural disaster beyond anybody's control, needed to seek refuge here in the U.S. And not because they didn't have valid passports, but because they didn't have a valid passport and a visa which, you know, as people are evacuating, is very hard to come by. If you can, if you think about grabbing up all those documents, it just seemed, you know, kind of reminiscent, you know, just to bring it closer to home, to turn away a friend.
Right.
This was a very powerful podcast for me because it really made me think about relationships in the sense of the United States is not an island. And we do need to have friendships across the world to ensure that we are safe.
Right. This notion of America first, which seems to be a hallmark of our current foreign policy, as I think we are beginning to see, if we haven't already come to understand, is not sustainable. You need your friends. And this country in particular, as we are often the target of a lot of animus, we find ourselves drawn into conflict because of the values that we represent. We're going to use northern Syria as an example, just like the Bahamas and in many other instances, to show where American values are exported to the wider world. What do they look like when we turn inward? Are we exporting the same values abroad that we live and honor, you know, in this country? Sometimes there are big disconnects between what we're exporting and what we're living. But the sad truth of our foreign policy these days, it seems, is that our foreign policy looks a lot like our domestic policy,
right?
Whether it be, you know, historic relationships, our relationships with and care for people of color and vulnerable communities. Mm-hmm. There's starting to be a real unfortunate alignment and a thread connecting our foreign policy and our domestic policy. And we should start thinking about it and not turning the channel when we hear about Syria or ISIS and understand why all those things have relevance in our lives.
Puerto Rico is a prime example of that. After Hurricane Maria, which has been, like, 2 years, there are still thousands, tens of thousands of people who still don't have safe and reliable housing in Puerto Rico.
There was the blue tarps, so-called blue tarps, that were put on the tops of homes whose roofs were blown away. Mm-hmm. And there were still blue tarps on people's homes by the time the second Hurricane Maria came. What I also found interesting is our president referred to the president of Puerto Rico in a very insightful gaffe that gives you real insight into the man's mind and his understanding of the world. Puerto Rico and the residents of Puerto Rico are Americans. Mm-hmm. They don't have a president. They don't have a prime minister. They are Americans.
Well, they do have a president.
They do have a president, and it was not the one that Donald Trump was referring to. There's a governor there, as there are in all of the protectorates and territories of the United States. But again, I think it shows that common thread that connects our foreign policy, whether it be the Kurds in northern Syria, the Bahamians, you know, who are victims of a natural disaster, or Americans in this country who are victims of a natural disaster. And that common thread, regrettably, is that these are people of color. So with that said, why don't we get right to the show? I think Haley is going to be a tremendous guest for us, and she's going to tell us a lot about what's going on in northern Syria, and drawing some parallels between the violence that we see, you know, in other parts of the country and the violence that we're seeing in this country, whether it be domestic terrorism or white nationalism or anti-Semitism. So let's get right to it. Haley, it's a pleasure to have you with us for the movement. This is the first show that we've ever recorded on national security issues and foreign affairs. So you should be proud to be our inaugural guest on this topic after having recorded 50 shows, more than 50 shows, in fact. But we thought it was really important to introduce to the broader Urban League movement this issue because it really goes to the heart of our personal security. National security is personal security. And the images that we project abroad, we hope,
are matching the way that we're behaving domestically. So that's the connection. That's the hook. Couldn't think of anybody better in town than to bring you to talk about what happened recently in northern Syria. Why don't you help our audience understand a little bit more about who you are and how you came to the role in the Obama administration and in the Congress?
Great. Well, thank you. I'm really honored to be here and grateful to speak to this audience. I am someone who wanted for some time to come to Washington to work in government. And I found my way here in October of 2000, so 19 years ago, with hopes and dreams of working for President Al Gore. So that quickly came crashing down.
Wasn't to be.
Was not to be, unfortunately. And I found my way to Capitol Hill, as did most Democrats during the Bush administration. I worked for four members of Congress, always working on national security and foreign policy issues. And also in the Obama administration, I was senior policy advisor to the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power. Most recently, we had the opportunity to work together, Clint, working for Senator Kamala Harris, where I worked as her national security advisor. And now I am leading an organization, the Jewish Democratic Council of America, which advocates for Jewish values, and we support elected officials and candidates who support such values.
Well, the National Urban League is a 501c3 organization, so we are nonpartisan. I'm just putting that out there, but the perspectives that you share today with us, and say anything that you want.
Well, thank you for having me.
The issue that brings us here today is foreign affairs and foreign policy, specifically as it relates to this current administration, and more specifically than that, northern Syria. Can you give us just a really brief history of the conflict in northern Syria, and why was there a need for U.S. military presence there, and what were we currently doing there?
Yes, as with many of these conflicts, you know, it starts as one thing and it evolves over time. So the conflict in Syria started as a civil unrest and a civil war in 2011. It was one of many kind of civil unrest that came from the Arab Spring, where populations were rising up against authoritarian leaders. In Syria, it was the Syrian population rising up against Bashar al-Assad, who unfortunately is still there, and now, 8 years later, has been responsible for the deaths of over 500,000 of his people. About 500,000 Syrians have been killed in this civil war, and over 1 million have been displaced throughout the region and throughout the world. And we've seen the results of that in terms of Syrian refugees who have sought refuge in our country as well. But over time, again, this conflict has evolved. So once the civil war was underway for a few years, there was a vacuum of leadership in northern Syria. And ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, after it rose up in Iraq in 2014, in the summer of 2014, eventually found a safe haven in northern Syria and kind of established its capital in northern Syria. And again, it was, you know, there was no real governing entity at that time in the area. And this terrorist organization, ISIS, exploited that vacuum of leadership. Now, we partnered with the Kurds on the ground in northern Syria to go after ISIS.
And who are the Kurds? I mean, we hear that term a lot. I know at a high level it's an ethnic minority, but who are they and how is it that we came to partner with them?
The Kurds are the largest ethnic minority in Syria. They make up about 5 to 10% of the Syrian population. And they live mostly in northern Syria, close to the border with Turkey. There are also Kurdish populations in Turkey, in Iraq, in Iran, but there is no country that has a Kurdish majority, and they do not have their own country. So we had partnered with the Kurds, and they were very effective in our fight against ISIS over the past few years. Over 11,000 Kurdish troops actually lost their lives in the fight against ISIS. And not only did they push ISIS out of their capital in northern Syria, but they detained hundreds of ISIS fighters. And we have been largely successful in our efforts to defeat ISIS because of our partnership with the Kurdish allies. So to answer the question of what were the troops doing there, they were working and training and helping the Kurds to combat ISIS and to ensure that northern Syria was not exploited by terrorist organizations that would pose a threat.
And because Turkey is an ally, they wouldn't very likely attack where U.S. forces were present. I mean, their presence had some effect in keeping Turkey out of there, right?
Although Turkey is a NATO ally, they have different interests than ours. They see the Kurds as a threat. We had seen the Kurds as an ally. And for some time, Turkey, viewing what they perceive as this threat on its border, wanted to go into northern Syria and push the Kurds out. And we had resisted that. We have been working with the Kurds. And when Donald Trump threatened to withdraw U.S. forces from Syria in late 2018, his Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, actually resigned because, for many reasons, but at the time, one of the reasons stated was that this partnership that had developed between the U.S. military and these Kurdish forces was sacrosanct in that we had to be there for our allies. And this notion that we would somehow acquiesce to Turkish demands and withdraw from Syria when it wasn't in our interests and wasn't in the interests of regional stability was something that the military was opposed to. And Mattis did cite this as a reason that he left the administration late last year.
So the president wakes up one morning, October 13th, Sunday, and he tweets, "We're out." Something along those lines. Talk about that and why the hell do you think he made that decision?
Well, importantly, before the tweet was a phone call. He spoke with the Turkish president, Erdogan. And as I mentioned, for some time, Turkey had been pressuring us, and specifically Trump, who, as we know, can be erratic. And believe me, foreign countries are trying to exploit the fact that he has no clear foreign policy. Turkey wanted us out of northern Syria because they wanted to go in. And he had a call with Erdogan. Erdogan asked us yet again to leave northern Syria, I believe even threatening that it was going in. And instead of demonstrating U.S. leadership and saying, no, it's in our interest and those of our allies and the Kurds to remain there, Trump acquiesced, he capitulated, he rolled over, he showed no spine, and he did what Turkey had asked, which was to abandon our Kurdish allies. And he ordered the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops.
So how do you think this decision impacted U.S. foreign relations with other countries who currently have us as allies or who may be considering us as an ally?
I think that this is really important. That gets to the danger here. There are a few dangers we face. In the near term, of course, there has been a humanitarian crisis in that Turkey initially was killing hundreds of Kurds. There was more displacement in terms of Kurds leaving northern Syria and seeking refuge elsewhere. But also, because we had abandoned them, other allies, as you mentioned, now question what partnership with the U.S. means. They're questioning our credibility as an ally and as a partner. And this is very important. I mean, the U.S., you know, should be trusted. We should be viewed as a leader. And this diminishes the way we are viewed in terms of our leadership and our partnerships by not just those in the region in the Middle East, but by all of our allies around the world.
So I saw footage of the U.S. troops exiting northern Syria, and the locals were actually pelting the departing soldiers with potatoes. This must have been viewed as a deep, deep betrayal by the Kurdish people.
Absolutely. And the Kurds, who were fearing, rightfully so, for their lives, did look to others that they could partner with. They reached out to the Russians, who were coming in quickly, literally passing U.S. troops on the highway. As we were going out, they were going in to see if they would provide the kind of safe haven refuge that the Kurds felt they needed. So yes, this was a betrayal, and the Russians have come in, whether it was directly through Russian troops or Syrian troops that Russia was backing. They have now come in to fill that vacuum.
You mentioned Russia, and just in a way, like they just sort of plopped into the scene. But I'm sure Russia was there before. Russia's interests have been involved all along. Why is it that a Russian flag is currently sailing or flying above what used to be a U.S. military compound in northern Syria? What's Russia's strategic interest here? Why are they all in the soup?
Well, Russia, for some time now, going back to 2015, again, similar to ISIS, sensing this vacuum of leadership in a country that was embroiled in a civil war, you know, they have exploited the opportunity to assert themselves in Syria for some time. So they have been in Syria since about 2015 through 2017. They were in Syria establishing a presence, supporting Assad, supporting his forces. But importantly, they were not in northern Syria where the U.S. troops were until we decided to leave. And seeking an opportunity to come in and fill this vacuum, the Russian troops came as soon as we announced we were leaving. And you're right, they have now taken over the bases that we very quickly abandoned. We left so quickly that we actually had to detonate, to bomb our own ammunition.
That's serious. So what's going on with the Kurds now, with their physical safety, with their progress with finding new allies? I mean, we've heard about the prospect of so-called ethnic cleansing mm-hmm. of the Kurds. Can you talk a little bit about the jeopardy that the Kurdish people are now facing as a result of this withdrawal?
So in the initial week, there was violence. The Turks went after the Kurdish fighters. The Turkish military went in, and hundreds were killed. There has been a ceasefire, which appears to be holding. However, this ceasefire, in terms of at least we've stopped the killing, has changed the balance of power in this region. Turkey is now essentially in northern Syria. We are out. Russia is in. And, you know, that fundamentally changes, the situation on the ground. Our presence there ensured that not only were we working with our Kurdish allies to go after ISIS and ensure that they were not going to resurge, but also that we, the U.S., were looking out for our interests just broadly in that region. And now we're no longer there. I mean, Trump has said that we are redeploying to protect oil fields, which is kind of bizarre. And, you know, I'm not quite sure if where we are exactly in the region. But it looks like we have abandoned, that region of northern Syria and the bases that we previously had. So the Kurds, yes, they have been looking for other partners. They have found it in Russia. And we are now facing a situation in which ISIS, many of the fighters were released. We could be facing a situation in which ISIS faces a resurgence, and this would be a real threat for us.
So last week, the president took to Twitter again to announce that U.S. forces had killed,
al-Baghdadi, who's the leader of ISIS. But what you're telling me is there are hundreds of ISIS fighters who were in detention that are now on the loose. Baghdadi has been killed. Has the death of al-Baghdadi done anything to reduce the presence of ISIS or the threat that ISIS poses to the United States and our national security?
Well, I should say the death of Baghdadi is a good thing when a leader of a terrorist organization is captured or killed. In this case, no one is mourning the loss of Baghdadi. But the operation in which he was killed was largely the result of our partnership with the Kurds. So it was kind of the dividend of the partnership that Trump has now undermined. So, you know, as much as he has touted this as a great success, even when he described it, he really failed to acknowledge this, that the partnership with the Kurds largely helped us to identify where he was. It takes those kind of partnerships and troops and special forces on the ground to collect the kind of intelligence that leads to this kind of operation.
So in this town, everything is viewed through a partisan lens. Any act that happens, maybe the Republicans like it, the Democrats don't like it, or vice versa. Now, this is one of the weird circumstances in town where everybody seems to agree that this is messed up and that we should not have done what we've done. Can you talk a little bit about some of the congressional reaction in the immediate aftermath about withdrawal and the kind of bipartisan disagreement with the policy?
Yeah, I mean, the response on the Hill was almost universally negative. Importantly, Congress was not consulted. They learned of this decision the same way the public did, via tweet, via news reports, which is really unprecedented. The administration should have at least alerted the leaders in Congress that something as large as this was about to happen. They did not. And what you heard was condemnation not only from Democrats, but also from key Republicans, such as Senator Lindsey Graham, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, and other allies of the president. That was important in that you don't typically hear them criticizing the president. So their initial response was quite negative. However, as time has gone on over the past few weeks, their criticism of the president on this issue is really diminished. So you haven't heard as much criticism from the Republicans on this issue. And, you know, I mentioned that there's been a ceasefire. It seems like they believe that that has somehow fixed the situation. It has not. So it is something that we all need to be watching, and it really shouldn't be viewed through a partisan lens.
So finally, just to bring it home, we have our own brand of terrorism here in the U.S. We've just recently commemorated some acts of white nationalism that happened with the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, 2-year anniversary of that. And then we also have the horrific gun attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. What kind of parallels can we draw from the president's treatment of terrorism abroad and terrorism here at home?
Yeah, I'm glad you've raised this because I think this is really important for both of our communities. You mentioned the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting. This was the largest anti-Semitic attack in American history, and we just marked 1 year since the loss of 11 Jews at that synagogue in Pittsburgh in October of 2018. And we know that Black churches and other places have been targeted by white nationalists, not just here in the United States, but also around the world. We have seen an emboldening of white nationalism since President Trump has been in office. And I think the common thread here is that the president refuses to see who our real enemies are and who our allies are. I mean, he equivocated in Charlottesville in condemning white nationalists. He said they were very fine people on both sides. He also, his administration really hasn't taken enough steps to identify white nationalist violence as domestic terrorism. And he hasn't done enough to protect our communities from this growing threat. you know, white nationalism, racism, anti-Semitism, xenophobia, these things did not start with President Trump, but there's no question that they have been emboldened during his administration. So I think our communities need to be working together to combat this common threat. And our president just doesn't seem to understand who our real partners are and who our enemies are, whether it's at home or abroad.
Well, our own CEO, Mark Morial, has spoken extensively about this problem. You know, we have been expressing condolences and sending prayers far too much in this country with the gun violence that has happened and the terrorism, whether it be domestic or international, that has led to led to all of these deaths. I would be interested in knowing, I know there are groups out there like the Anti-Defamation League, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, and our respective organizations have probably been looking at this issue as well. What do you think are some of the things that we could be working on? And I know we've worked on, even when we were back in the Senate, trying to get funding restored for these in Homeland Security to address these domestic terrorist threats. We've been looking, you know, for international funding, you know, to address these white nationalists and other threats. But what are some of your thoughts about some of the ways that we could be working together more closely?
Yeah, I think it's important for Congress to recognize the rise in hate crimes, whether it's religious, racial, or ethnic-based hate crimes, and what is causing it, looking at the root causes and doing more to protect our places of worship, which have been impacted. I mean, much of this goes through the Department of Homeland Security. And if they're not recognizing white nationalism as a domestic terrorist threat, then we've all got a real problem. More has to be done within Homeland Security. And this starts, I mean, it starts with the president, but Congress has a role to play here, and they could be doing more. There's been a real reluctance on the part of Republicans in Congress to do more to recognize the rise of hate crimes, which even the FBI has been tracking. There's no refuting the facts, but there's been a reluctance to do more about it. And more can be done, and we should, as communities that are both impacted by this, we should be working together to combat this common threat.
Well, this is just the start of the conversation, and we're going to keep it going, and we're going to find ways to work together. So we want to thank you, Haley, for being here, taking time out of your busy schedule to come and talk to us and to the people of the Urban League movement. If I wanted to follow you on social media, for instance, and keep up with what Haley's doing, what would you send me to on different social media platforms to follow you?
Sure. Well, first, our organization is JewishDems.org or US Jewish Dems and Twitter. And I also have a Twitter account, Haley Soifer, HaleySoifer. I'm on Twitter. And, you know, we are a values-driven organization. We're advocating for Jewish values, but it's really not specific just to our community. We know we share these values with other communities, and we are looking for ways to partner. So I think that this is an important partnership that's begun here. So thank you.
Well, we're excited, and we thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for the lesson in foreign affairs and how it is relevant to us every day. So I appreciate you for bringing that home for us.
Great. Thank you.
In our affiliate spotlight, we would like to recognize the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh under the leadership of its president and CEO, Ms. Esther Bush. Recently, the affiliate received a generous gift to secure its future of serving the community, a 3-story business innovation center donated by the Regional Industrial Development Corporation of Southwestern Pennsylvania. This space will now be used by the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh to provide social services to strengthen individuals and families, including housing counseling, early childhood and parenting education, health programs, and career support. Congratulations on your continued growth and expansion to better serve the residents of the Greater Pittsburgh area. To learn more about the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh, follow them on Twitter at ULPGH and visit their website at www.ulpgh.org. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to rate us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Kudos to our production team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to For the Movement, presented by the National Urban League.